St. Louis is known, of course, for many things, from its first-class cultural institutions to toasted ravioli, from the king of beers to rolling stops at stop signs. And there's lots in between, from the iconic to the quirky. Most all of it is included in a new book titled What's with St. Louis? The Quirks, Personality, and Charm of the Gateway City. The author is veteran writer Valerie Battle Kinzel, and she joins me in studio. Valerie, so nice to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, congratulations on the book. It's a lot of fun to browse through, and I'm sure you had a lot of fun putting it together.
I sure did, yes.
What was the genesis of this? What got you interested in putting such a project together?
Well, I actually am not a native of St. Louis. I'm a transplant. I've been here since 1980, so for 36 years. I got together with the owner-publisher of Reedy Press, Josh Stevens. He said, come up with a list of things that you as an outsider have found intriguing or quirky or interesting. And he is a native, and so he said, I'll come up with a list. And so we put our two lists together and came up with 75 items that are included in this book.
I would have the feeling that once you get started compiling that list, that it just grew and grew.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And there were other items that we couldn't include. It would have been a much lengthier book. And this was supposed to be a quick read.
Okay, well, there's just a second book in the offering. You've got that ready to go. How would you describe, in the basis of your research, how would you describe St. Louis's personality?
I compare it to a patchwork quilt. It's made up of lots of different kinds of people, ethnicities, cultures, interests, jobs, foods, lots of different things. And so the pieces themselves may not be attractive, but once you put it together, it's like your grandmother's quilt. It's a beautiful finished product. It's just lots of pieces make a beautiful whole.
How long have you been here?
Since 1980, 36 years.
Oh, well, you know it all then. You've been around
here. No, no.
Well, think back, if you would, to when you first came here, and what got you scratching your head about this community and saying, what is going on here?
The first one was the question that invariably came up at office parties or in the workplace or neighborhood barbecues. Where'd you go to high school?
Isn't that incredible?
It is. Yeah. Because where I came from, nobody cares. That's not a question.
Where did you come from?
Nashville, Tennessee.
Uh-huh. Well, that's not so far away. Well, that is included in your book. Have
yes.
you come to any conclusions about why we, and I don't know of any other community where that is the predominant question or paramount question. Any idea why that question is asked here?
Well, the answer is there is no definitive answer. I have talked to people of all ages who are lifelong residents here, lived in the city, and the answers range from it's a cultural definition, it's a way to determine religious affiliation, it's a method of knowing if you went to one high school, you didn't want to be friends with somebody that attended a rival high school due to sports teams. So there really is no one set answer that I've been able to find.
Well, it is a very curious thing because most of what I've heard over the years is it's really kind of a status thing. You can weigh the person with whom you're speaking, as to what their relative the comparatives between yourself and that person. Mm-hmm. They went to an affluent school or a not-so-affluent school. It tells you a lot about them.
That's judgmental type thing.
Exactly. You put it a lot better than I have. You had to start somewhere in the book, and you started with food. And I think it's the longest chapter in your book. Why start with food?
Because we have such a wide ethnic population here. There are all kinds of foods and food influences. And so the very first item I did was on Gus's Pretzels. Now, being not from here, I would go to ball games and I would stop at intersections downtown when there was a sporting event or something going on downtown. And I would see these people with pretzel sticks in paper and wondered, what in the world is that all about? And is it sanitary? Is it safe? Is it okay? And then I tried a Gus's pretzel. Mm. Oh, my gosh. And so I thought, that's a great one to start with. And plus, it's a third-generation family firm, which those are not too much around anymore, things that have been generation to generation. And they use the same basic recipe they've used since they were established in 1920. No preservatives. And I just think that's a wonderful thing to start with.
And there are some other things, obviously, about St. Louis that are, I'll say, unique to this community. I mean, Emo's Pizza is not sold anyplace else that I'm aware of.
No. I have a nephew who lives in Buffalo, and he is a restaurateur, and he comes here, and he tries it. He said it's like eating a white cheese on a cracker. He's not a big fan. He likes the thick crust.
Well, and pizza on the East Coast is a lot different than it is in this part of the country.
Yes, it is.
And, of course, that white cheese is, and of itself, a story.
Yes, it is. It's nowhere else can you go. You go and ask for a sandwich with Provel in another part of the country, and people will probably give you a blank stare and say, what are you talking about? But it is a unique combination. They're actually, what I found in my research, there are two families that claim to have come up with the idea. I won't go into a lot of details about that, but it is a combination of processed cheddar and Swiss cheese and provolone. And the research I found said Provel on the patent doesn't really mean anything. It's just sort of a jumble of letters.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you've got that. That's another item that you have included in your book.
Yes.
What about pork steaks? I don't know of any other places in the country where pork steaks are as popular
exactly,
as I hear.
Exactly. When first moved here, had pork steaks and just found they were fabulous. And that they were in the grocery, usually packaged in large quantities to serve big families or whatever. And then I went back to Tennessee, one of the local grocers there, and went to the butcher. And I said, where are your pork steaks, please? And he just gave me one of those blank looks. He's like, what are you talking about? I said, you know, pork steaks. He says, no, pork comes from cows. This is the South. This is, you know, this is where the pork comes, the meat comes from. So he said, are you talking perhaps about the pork butt, which is part of the pork shoulder? He said, yeah, I know what that is, but no, we don't have them.
And once again, it's something that is unique to this city.
Yes.
And another thing that comes to mind, and I'm sure a lot of people listening right now are mouthing, and that is toasted ravioli, which is another one of those St. Louis things.
Yes, yes. And there are a couple of places that claim to have perfected that and found that it was somewhat of an accident. But what a tasty accident. And I talked to staff at Charlie Gito's, and they prepare 10,000 a week. And go through them all. It's kind of a tedious process, but very interesting.
Do you get into how they came into being? I mean, one hears that they were an accident of some sort.
Yes. The best I could find was that they were perhaps dropped in the oil. Somebody was making ravioli, dropped them in oil by accident, tasted the mistake, and thought, this is pretty good, and decided to put some coating on them, some breadcrumbs to enhance it even further.
Tell me something about your research, because obviously you cover such a wide variety of subjects that you would have to have a wide variety of sources to come up with the text for your book.
I did many, many interviews with people. Josh Stevens was very much a proponent of let's talk to local experts. Let's find out what they say. So I did that. I spent just hours in research libraries, became really good friends with old musty books, strained my eyes reading screens of old information and that kind of thing. But it was a wonderful journey.
Is there any one thing in the book or any one thing that you discovered or learned that blew you away, just totally came out of the blue and surprised you?
I've told this some of the other
interviewers
I've given. It's the Bell Fountain and Calvary cemeteries that were part of the rural cemetery movement and established the mid-1800s. And there was a story about a well-known madam who was trying to make arrangements for her end and where she was going to be buried. And she approached Bell Fountain Board of Directors, and they said, no, I'm sorry. That's not going to happen. You cannot purchase a lot here. And she said, well, okay, I'm going to talk to the wives of some of you and let them know how I know you.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that's called blackmail.
Well, she
coercion
got,
or something.
She got what she wanted, and so she is buried in a plot, and there's nobody around her. And apparently she was so well thought of that the funeral procession from downtown to the cemetery, there were like 1,000 people that lined the streets. And she also gave her money to the poor when she passed.
There are a lot of very, very famous people who are buried in our cemeteries, including the two in particular that you've just mentioned.
Yes. William Tecumseh Sherman, Dred Scott, mm-hmm. Let's see, Kate Chopin. August Bush, yes.
Yes, but they're so interesting. Did you spend a lot of time there, in the cemeteries yourself?
No, and I would like to go back. I understand, that you can take an arbor tour and see all the different species of trees and plants and fauna, too.
It's also a fascinating walk through history because just mm-hmm. Some of the few that you've mentioned here, so prominent in America's history that you kind of feel like you're following that path somehow.
Yes, and where else can the infamous and the famous be buried? I mean, we all die, and we can all mingle and mix together in a cemetery.
Well, at that particular stage, we're all the same, regardless
yes.
of what
cares?
We've done. Exactly. I'm going to take a break. We're talking with Valerie Kinzel, and her book was What's with St. Louis? The Quirks, Personality, and Charm of the Gateway City. We'll be back and continue the conversation. If you'd like to be a part of it, if you have questions about some of the things that are included or you think should be included or that you'd like to know more about, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org, or if you would prefer to send us a tweet, we'll take that as well at STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back as we continue our conversation with Valerie Kinzel, the author of What's with St. Louis? I guess it has a question mark, so what's with St. Louis? I suppose that should be the inflection,
yes.
Maybe.
Yeah.
The Quirks, Personality, and Charm of the Gateway Cities. So where's the charm? What charm did you find?
All the green spaces. We have so many wonderful parks and green spaces and just the cultural institutions, things around and in Forest Park, those kind of things. And architectural details in the city. You just walk and look up and you see just what a magnificent city it is architecturally.
Yeah, you talk about it as being a quilt, and that's a very apt description, I think, because it does bring the very old and the very new. I was at a meeting last night where they were talking about this new building they're going to put on King's Highway. Talk about new. I mean, that is so totally different looking from anything we have in this city. It's going to be interesting to watch that go up.
Yes, it will be.
Yeah, right. We are starting to get some calls, so let's bring folks in and get them into the conversation. We'll start with Jim, who's calling from Wildwood. Jim, thanks for being with us. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I understand that. Obviously St. Louis is a beer town, but understand that there were some soft drinks that were developed in St. Louis over the years.
Aha, it's in the book.
Yes, yes. St. Louis was somewhat of a hotbed for soft drink development. It also coincided with that unfortunate implementation called the Prohibition, which lasted from 1920 to 1933. And drinks like Howdy and Orange Smile and 7-Up. And 7-Up was one of those intriguing products that nobody really knew the name, the origin of the name, because C.L. Gregg, the developer, never revealed it.
Well, that's another mystery that remains unsolved, at least for the moment. Wasn't Vess a big name here at one time?
Yes, too? Yes. And there's still the 1950s-era bottle that's down near I-70 downtown. And that sort of speaks to the soft drink past.
Yeah. Well, most people, as Jim indicated here, don't really recognize the fact that we have a soft drink past because beer is so prominent. Do you get into that part of it at all, the beer background?
Oh, yes.
How could you not?
Yes. there was such a large influx of German population, and they brought with them their recipes for beer. And remarkably, there were some underground caves that were found in downtown St. Louis. And what a great thing for a beer manufacturer. They've got a cool place to store their product. So at one time, there were over 40, and a lot of them were smaller. But it's really interesting to see how the beer industry progressed from small starts.
I wonder if they're in any use today, those caves. Did you have any idea?
I asked the Landmarks Association of St. Louis, and they, you know, were very helpful with providing information. But as far as they know, there are none that are really used today. There are Wild Caves and Show Cave. Show Cave would be like Merrimack or Onondaga. But as far as the Landmarks Association people knew, there are not caves that are currently in use. A lot of them have caved in. They weren't supported structurally. They've been vacant for decades.
Mm-hmm. I know that you give some attention to this in your book, but I want to talk for a moment about the hill before we go back into the phones. Mm-hmm. That had to be an interesting part of your research. It's quite a neighborhood and has been for a long time.
Yes, it is. And that was an area that I didn't realize how important they were to the brick production. At one time, St. Louis was the largest producer of bricks in the United States. And even on the secondhand market, St. Louis bricks are still in demand, repurposed St. Louis bricks. The hill had something called a Cheltenham sinkline. It was a type of clay that was particularly good for use in brick production. And the Italian immigrants that came and moved to the area, they were looking for work, and a lot of them ended up settling on the hill and became involved with the production of bricks. A lot of the terracotta, if you look downtown, the details on the buildings, terracotta, that was all because of that wonderful amount of clay, that section of clay on the hill.
And as you've indicated, the St. Louis brick very much in demand in other parts of the country, I think particularly New Orleans. For some reason, New Orleans is especially attracted to St.
Yes.
Louis brick. And a lot of the vacant houses that have been torn down, that's where the bricks wind up, is in New Orleans. Let's take another phone call here. Olga joins us from North St. Louis County. Olga, go ahead. You're on the air with Valerie.
I'm really enjoying this. I'm 83 and grew up in St. Louis, and we never had any kind of class, religious, anything. It was geographic. I had a cousin that went to McKinley High School. It made a difference to me at Harris Teachers College, and maybe somebody knew him. The other was, while we had wonderful bus transportation, if somebody had a car and they lived in North St. Louis, and I lived in Walnut Park, and that was way far north, you know, maybe I could get a ride. Hearing this as people move in here and hear that, it's like, no, it's where do you live? You know, you live close to me. Do you know my cousin or my aunt or my uncle? So I wanted to get that spin on it from somebody who's 83.
A real practical purpose then for asking asking that question.
Yeah, because I went to school in St. Louis Public Schools, and I went to Harris Teachers College, which was in the city. I went to Washington U, which was in the city. And, you know, well, it would take two buses and a streetcar to get to Wash U. If somebody could give me a ride that lived in North St. Louis and maybe went to a Catholic high school that was north, I'd know that they lived somewhere close to me. So, anyway.
Well, thank you so much for the call.
You're welcome.
There's another reason for you, Valerie.
One more reason, yes.
You know, I've been here for 45 years. I came from another state, and I have never, ever been asked where I went to high school. I may be the only person in town that question has not been asked of, but I've always found that interesting.
Amazing, yeah.
Because you were asked, I assume, at some point.
Many times.
Yeah, right.
Many times.
Oh well. I don't know. Maybe people just don't care about this guy. All righty. Well, let's bring in Tom. He's calling from Webster Groves. Tom, thanks for being with us. You're on the air with Valerie Kinzel.
Hey, thank you. I'm really enjoying the show also. I grew up in Webster Groves in St. Louis, and I'm in my 60s, and there was always a term that was kind of derogatory towards people. Usually it would be equivalent to white trash, and that was to call somebody a Hoosier. Is that a St. Louis thing?
It's in the book. Go ahead, Valerie.
Yes, it is. yes. In other parts of the country, they might be called rednecks or hayseeds, something like that. But yes, it's usually used as a derogatory term, somebody that maybe has plastic flowers in their flower pots, even when there's 6 inches of snow on the ground, but it adds a pop of color in winter and it looks pretty. Or somebody, a woman who puts on a nice outfit and she puts on a dab of lipstick and a scarf over her pink plastic curlers that are in her hair because she might run into somebody at the grocery store. So, or somebody who... The real definition for me was somebody I worked with, and her mother was talking about leaving her Christmas tree in the corner all year round, and she just left the lights, the decorations, everything on it. She threw a sheet over it, and that's where the tree stayed, 365. Yep.
Now, do people in Kansas City use that term, or is that a St. Louis thing, or do you know?
I don't know. That I don't know. But Hoosier is the only time I've heard that used in a derogatory manner is here in St. Louis.
Okay.
And I have had a couple of people who I talked to who were from Indiana said, you know, that's kind of an insult that you're kind of disrespecting us.
Yes, that's right. Okay, thanks.
Tom, thanks for the call. Are there any other parts of our language that you came across that are unique to St. Louis? Like Hoosier?
Yeah, well, some of the pronunciations, and there's no real way to know. The guess, I talked to a language specialist at WashU, and it probably has to do with all the different ethnicities and different people moving into town, and they hear a word, and then they pronounce it the way they think it should be pronounced, but it might not be quite right, like washed or quater. Or Sunda instead of ice cream sundae, or farty far, yes. And then it becomes part of the language vernacular.
I have to point out, next week we're going to be doing a program on dialects and that sort of thing that will include what we've just been talking about here. So be sure to listen in.
Okay.
Be sure to listen in. We can't talk about St. Louis without talking sports. It's a big sports town.
Yes.
Where did you go with that in the book?
We talk about some of the defunct teams, the St. Louis Stars, the St. Louis Browns, a couple of the basketball teams that were here. But then we also talk about Cardinal Nation and what a fabulous fanatic fan base we have for the baseball Cardinals here in St. Louis.
How about football?
Yeah.
A subject of some conversation recently. But
yeah. Not too much to be said about that. The Blues, we talk about the Blues. What a fabulous fan base they have. They're called the Note. Their followers are called the Note. There's Louie. There's the Towel Man. There's little ditties they do. The Zamboni machines. You know, it's just that's an experience to go to a hockey game.
Another thing that St. Louis has some pride in, of course, is its musical history.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Blues in particular.
Yes. The National Blues Museum opened in April on Washington Avenue. And it's the only place in the country where you can look at the local, national, and international blues development and to see how it's been traced. And some people I've talked to didn't realize that the blues genre really sort of started with W.C. Handy. I mean, yes, blues music had been around. It's irregular rhythms. It has a lot of emotion and speaks of love gone wrong and life kicking you to the sidewalks and everything. But W.C. Handy and the St. Louis Blues song that he wrote really was pretty much instrumental in getting that genre going.
And is known around the country and perhaps much of the world as something to identify with St. Louis.
Yes, and so we're very much blessed, I think, to have a museum like that caliber here in St. Louis.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Marty will join us from North St. Louis County. Marty, go ahead. You're on the air.
I was wondering if she had ever heard the term scrubby Dutch. We used to have homes with front porches and steps that were made of white stone, and every Saturday people would be out there scrubbing their white steps. Luckily, where I grew up, we only had a wooden porch, but we still had to clean it real good once in a while. And also, when I grew up, the Irish, I think, had lace curtains, and I was from German heritage, and I guess at one time we had lace curtains on the windows, too. So I really am interested in her book. I think it's really neat, so thank you.
Well, it is available. How about scrubby Dutch?
That is not addressed in the book per se, but yes, I did encounter that, and usually in reference to people of German origin. I didn't encounter anything about the Irish and lace, though, but I did hear about scrubby Dutch, and it was like a real status thing to have really immaculately clean stone steps.
You know, I lived in Baltimore for a while, and it was a long time ago, but as I remember, that term was also used there because they had the row houses, and of course it was a big thing to scrub the steps leading into these places. Okay, we have a double here with two people writing about the same thing, Shannon and Rick. I've never heard of trick-or-treaters telling a joke to get candy on Halloween before I moved here. Rick says the same thing. Do you know the origin of why and how that got started?
That's one of those topics that we didn't have room to include. But, yes, that seems to be a St. Louis thing. I did a little bit of research on that and didn't find anything anywhere else where people ask, tell me a joke before you get your treats.
With the World's Fair. I know you include that in your book. What did you find out about that that's maybe something we don't know?
That iced tea and hot dogs were not, and ice cream cones were not invented here. They were popularized here. Puffed wheat was introduced here. But the other items that are sometimes associated with the World's Fair, they were just popularized. They were not introduced here.
The hot dog, no, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hamburger? No.
Nope.
The ice cream sandwich? No.
No.
You're shooting down all these stories that we've grown up with here in St. Louis.
That's what the research said. I'm not making this up.
Really? All right. How about religion? It's the Catholic community here is very strong. A number of churches and religion is dealt with in your book. What sorts of things did you find out there?
That we have two basilicas in St. Louis, which is rather unusual that a city would have two basilicas, and that means they have been given that designation and distinction by the Pope in Rome. And one is the old cathedral downtown, which sits close to the riverfront, and it is the only piece of property that is still owned in St. Louis's history from 1764 by the same owner, which is the Archdiocese of St. Louis. And then the new cathedral, the one with the millions and millions of mosaic tiles. So they're both basilicas.
Another area that is interesting, and a lot of people talk about this with some frequency, and that is you spend a lot of time talking about streets and things related to streets. Mm-hmm. And in promoting this program, I made much of the rolling stop sign, which I think everybody is aware that is something that happens a lot in the city of St. Louis.
Yes, it does. Yeah. In fact, there are 22,000 stop signs in the city of St. Louis. I talked to the director of streets to get that information. There are 1,000 streets. And yes, there is actually an ordinance on the record books, a law that says you must come to a full and complete stop, not just a casual look left and right and keep rolling. But you need to come to a stop where your car does that little jerk when you're at a complete stop.
So why don't we stop? Why do we roll through?
Because there are so many stop signs. That's as much as I could tell. But stop signs are actually what the streets department says. They are put there to aid traffic flow, to protect pedestrians. They're not put there, contrary to what people think, to be a hindrance and a pain. They're actually there for a purpose and a reason.
Aren't there just about as many one-way streets in the city of St. Louis?
There are a lot of one-way streets, and that goes back to the original street grid when the city was first laid out. A lot of the streets were very narrow, really too narrow to accommodate two-way traffic. So back in 1923, when the automobiles started really becoming a thing in St. Louis, some of the streets were designated as one-way streets for safety.
How long did it take you to put all of this together?
About 8 months.
Well, I'm surprised it didn't take longer. You must have worked very, very quickly.
I found something I was fascinated in, and so, yeah, I spent a lot of time with it.
Just in the few seconds we have left, any people come to mind that you focused on? Not Adolphus Bush or any of those folks or former mayors or people like
probably
that?
Probably the man that has Courtesy Diner, and just some of the local diners down in St. Louis that have things like the Slinger or just places with character and flavor, and you can go and get a meal and socialize 24 hours.
That takes us back to where we started, food. Which is where you start with the book. The book is What's with St. Louis? Say the title for me so I can get the right inflection.
What's with St. Louis?
Okay. Okay. Thank you so much, Valerie Kinzel, for being with us. What's with St. Louis is the title of the book, and it's available where fine books are sold, right?
All over, yes.
All right. Great for Christmas season. Bye. Good stocking stuffer. Thank you for being with
Thank
us.
Thank you.
Okay. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.